Let's call this meeting to order.
And Representative Lean, did you read the minutes of the last meeting?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I will move them.
Very well. Representative Lean moves the minutes of February what?
19th.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Okay, first we have House File 91. Representative Nornes. Welcome to our committee. Please describe your bill to us.
Have to get comfortable, Mr. Chair, first.
Take your time.
Okay.
You're almost as old as I am. Well, take your time.
We won't discuss that today.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for hearing House File 91. Over the years, I've worked quite closely with the economic development folks that are part of my district, and one of the topics that would always come up is an empty toolbox. Pretty hard to compete with North Dakota and South Dakota, other places, when our toolbox is kind of empty. We did have the Jobs E program for a while, and that was okay. So what I was looking for is something more easier to understand and simple to execute if a community or county decides to go this route. And what this bill does, basically, is allows for example, you have an industrial park. In Fergus Falls, we have a new industrial park, but it's so new, there's no buildings on it yet. So you have a situation where you're ready to expand and draw some new business to our community, but there's no housing, nowhere to house this new business. So what this bill does simply allows for the construction of a building, and it allows the community or the county to exempt that property from property tax for a period of up to 5 years until it's occupied, until it's generating some income. And that is really the bottom line and the purpose of this bill, is to allow for some, in rural Minnesota particularly, opportunity for growth. If you have a business that's coming to your community looking to see what you have to offer, if you have nothing to offer, they will go where they can find a building. So that's kind of how simple it is. It's up to 5 years. The local community, there's some specifics in here. First of all, they have to notify. There has to be a public hearing. As much as possible, this housing should not compete with an existing building. I'm not sure how you police that completely, but the understanding would be that it's to bring new business, new industry to a community. Again, targeted at rural Minnesota.
Okay, it's my understanding, Representative Nordis, that this building is owned by the city. Is that correct?
As I envision it, it doesn't necessarily have to be. It could be privately built and privately owned. If the city owned it, then you wouldn't be dealing with the tax situation, I don't believe, anyway. So the understanding would be somebody deciding to build a building for possible job growth, and it also can be used if you're expanding, if you intend to expand an existing business. So if you have tax increment financing, you've got ways to probably use an abatement or some other. There are some other methods, but all of them are somewhat complicated, and this one does not affect any other business, to my knowledge. So with tax increment financing, somebody is paying for that. Well, you get the benefit from it. So this, I have to probably share with you, this is not a new idea, but some of our neighboring states already do it.
In other words, you're saying North Dakota does this?
I didn't name an eight, okay. a state, but they're also cutting their taxes by 10%. But that's just a slip of the tongue.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not totally enthusiastic about your bill, Representative Nordis, I have to say. But
a little bit.
Maybe not even a little bit. I served on my local school board during the time of Job Z, which was not a particularly successful program that this is sort of like in some respects. But one of the things, though, I tried really hard to support Job Z at the beginning because I did want to see businesses expand and grow. It was also cutting out of the tax base in my local community. And as a school board member, I was watching Mayo Clinic and others utilize the Job Z enhancement, but it was not benefiting the city, the county, and the school district for 5 or 10 years. And so I'm seeing this as having that similar effect, that you're giving a business a break on property taxes, but at the same time you're going to negatively affect the property tax base of your school districts, your cities, and your counties. So it's where who you're trying to benefit at
Representative
this point.
Norton, I'm not clear on how I do that. Can you explain that to me? How
yes,
I affect negatively the school district?
Because if you have a new, an expanded property building, and there's a property tax base for that, and they're not paying property taxes, that money isn't going into your school levies and your county and your city. So, I mean, that's a choice that you might be making with this bill, like Job Z did. It was a choice that was made for a number of years, and as I said, not particularly successfully. So, Can you address that at all, or it's just a choice?
I don't know if you can do it perfectly without having at least some unforeseen negative impact. My intention, because again, the city, the county, whoever's issuing this also has the taxing authority. To me, this has to be something at the local control where they decide in the best interest of the community. This is a good thing to do. Again, there has to be a hearing, so the public is aware of it. Anyone else interested would be aware of it, and so it doesn't. It's not an automatic. It just gives them the authority to do that. So, it's just one more thing. The tax increment financing is to me a lot more difficult and cumbersome, and that favors. I know a business that was actually built because of tax increment financing, and it turned into a war between an existing business because they got this preferential treatment. I don't envision that happening in this case. This is for expansion of a new business where you're building a building, hopefully someday, that a taxpayer or a rent payer will occupy.
Representative Norton.
Hey, Mr. Chair, so as I'm looking at who will grant this authority, it says the governing body of a municipality made by resolution grant. And if, I guess I would just raise this point, that if you're granting an exemption to property taxations because of a new building or improvements, A, you're only doing it for certain businesses, and I suspect all the businesses in your community would like a 5-year hiatus on paying property taxes.
Well, if they want to build a new building, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Well, building or not, I think everybody would like that reprieve. But that if you do that, it should be all the entities that are affected that would have to grant that authority, which would include your cities, your counties, and your school districts, and maybe even a township if they're involved, rather than just the governing body of the municipality, because that property taxation is going to affect all of those.
For somebody who doesn't believe in Job Z, you sure cited it pretty well.
Well, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it fairly.
There you go. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornes, you said that it could be an existing building, but they would existing business, but it would be a new building that they were building onto. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, yes.
Okay. I'm just thinking about when I sat on the school board, we did a tax abatement for a housing area that the community asked us to do for a 5-year. And then the county, the the city brought it to us, the county and the school district okayed that tax abatement for that 5 years. It seems to be running very well. They've actually done it again two more times. And I remember when we were first discussing this, I thought, should we be doing this? But I think about there's a business in my district that would really like to expand, and they're running into all kinds of problems with just different issues. And they actually got some funding from, I believe it was Deed, if they hired a whole bunch of people, which was great. But he said, I can't do it without adding the building. And he said, it just isn't going to work. And it's in a very remote area. The small community would have to give permission for something like this. But I think this could work really well. And this is something that he probably wouldn't be paying taxes for the time that you would be building it. Because once you had it up and running, you'd be paying taxes, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
So, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, talk about the expansion. The same thing could happen if you got a business that's up and running. They would like to expand for the future, maybe, so they could go ahead and build onto that addition that's not currently even being used. When it's being used and when it's fully utilized, then again the tax exemption would go away. So the intention of this is to provide some incentives to provide sort of some job growth, and again in greater Minnesota, and do it in an easy, simple way to do it. So I'm not surrounded by a lot of people that are supporting this. I'm kind of doing it by myself because I think it's a good thing. And in North Dakota, it's kind of the incubator, so I'm just benefiting from their experience. So.
Very well. You're done?
Okay.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So I have some very similar concerns as Representative Norton, but I do understand, you know, and hear you when you talk about, you know, business growth and job growth and creating opportunities in the rural communities. You know, I would say those are a lot of the things that I would love to see in my community, right, in my district, to create an opportunity to give, to bring in a bigger workforce. But the problem is that when you look at capping or exempting property taxes, which really fund education, and I know exactly what you mean because I have a district that we are like tax poor. Just no tax base at all. Ramsey County has absolutely no tax base. And so, but that really has a huge impact on our educational systems, you know. And I know that, you know, as we talk about, you know, our educational system and giving our young people an opportunity, you know, within that system, having the supplies and the tools and the supplies that they need, it really, really does impact that system because we are unfortunate. You know, our schools are funded through property taxes. And so, you know, it will have a huge impact, you know, and it leaves a whole community burdened by this business that you want to create jobs. But I have a question, too. Have you been in contact with Deed about this bill?
No, I have not. No.
Mr. Chair. Do you have any plans to make, you know, have some connections or contact with Deed?
It kind of depends on how this bill is, whether it's alive or not. And if it's moving forward and there's some interest in it, again, my whole motivative, Representative Moran and Mr. Chair, is to find some incentive for people to invest their money to create some jobs. And I guess we'd have to do some more talk on how it impacts. Because to me, the community needs to exempt the whole package. So it's got some value. The building would have some value, but it doesn't work. What I'm trying to do doesn't work if suddenly you're shifting those taxes supposedly to somebody else. And that's what tax increment financing does. So we have not done anything different. So what I'm trying to do is something different.
Another question?
Well, yeah, I would just say, you know, Mr. Chair, is to look, you know, into the impact this will have on a community and in a larger way, but also have that conversation with Deed and talk to your schools.
Yeah, I will do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nornes. Just to follow up on Representative Norton's thoughts about how this would impact the school districts, I believe my numbers are correct. In 2012, 80% of the bond issues that were forwarded in school districts passed, and local school districts decided to invest greatly. This is, you know, I can see where this is kind of pulling the rug out on them financially a little bit. I don't know to what extent, but with that said, I do have a question about the warehousing and storage portion of this. Are we talking about storage units for boats and cars and whatever? Because if that's the case, I've got a little bit of a problem with that. Those businesses do enjoy 100% rental capacity, so I wouldn't like to see helping a business that's already flourishing out of control already. So.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know if there's a way that that could happen where a building like that could be built. That's not the intent. It's to create jobs. That's the whole idea of it. And when jobs are created, the whole package kicks into gear, taxes paid, everybody's happy. And at the end of the 5 years, if there's nobody in it, then the taxes kick in anyway. So there's some incentive there to.
Next, we have Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I think this is a great idea. It's living in greater Minnesota, I see a lot of businesses that want to expand. But when in the initial expansion, a lot of them fail because of the overburden, not just on with the other bills and stuff. It's the overburden of taxes on them now. Once they get their feet in the ground, they can handle that. And in that five-year window that they'd have to get their the expansion or the new business up and running and all that other stuff, it'll help their business, actually help business grow and help the community and the economy of that community. Now, if they can get these new employees go up and running and some of these new employees coming in, they might be building new houses, furthering the tax base for the schools. But in order for these communities to thrive, they have to get their businesses up and running and their businesses on solid footing so they can hire the new employees. So I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward.
You represent Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, it's nice to see a greater Minnesota legislator doing something for all of Minnesota here, because I think this bill pertains to every, as I'm reading it, municipality means the statutory or home rule charter city in which the property is located. So St. Paul, Minnesota, Minneapolis, I got a number of questions. So it's a flat out exemption for the first 5 years. Doesn't matter if they get people renting the property or make use of the property sometime in those 5 years. Is that correct?
I guess technically it is. It's that probably needs to be modified a little bit. The intent was to be exempt until it's occupied. That was okay. My original intent. So it's not. So it could be only a year if they find somebody that's ready to make use of the space. So if that's not spelled out the way it should be, then that's how I would.
Hopefully, you're taking notes.
Yeah,
Mr. Chair. If I might continue. So is there any clawbacks to something like this that would prevent an old business, say you had Tom's Tire two blocks away, this business gets up and running, it's in there a year or a year and a half, you know, your building, your pole barn, your storefront is up, and Tom's Tire down the road says, hell, they got, you know, they got really nice facilities there. I'm going to move. I'm going to leave this storefront that's two blocks down and go into this one, you know, this new building. Is there any way to, are you preventing that in any way, shape, or form, or is that within the preview of what you're trying to do also?
I'm not trying to do that, but I don't address that either.
Okay.
In rural Minnesota, that probably wouldn't happen.
You guys aren't any different than we are. You may think so, but you're not. I got country cousins. They're all the same. They're just like me. Can you imagine that?
No.
So who pays for the sewer and water connection out to the new building? Typically, through this division or in a number of different places, you get requests to deed or to PFA that says, you know, we needed $300,000 to put a 8-inch or a 12-inch or a 16-inch sewer line out to this new place that we're going to, and then we also need a 2-inch water line with XYZ pressure. Who's paying for that one? Is that the developer? Because typically it's paid by the city, and they come to the state for the money.
Don't know if I've got a real good answer for that. I assume it would be the builder and the city would have to negotiate that somehow. What I'm thinking of primarily is communities that have an industrial park where that's already part of the infrastructure. All they need is buildings. And not every community is in that shape, but a lot of them are. And so that's, you know, that's that could be an issue.
Mr. Chair. If there's a nose underneath the tent, they'll get there. So that's something you likely have to address, because otherwise we'll see a whole lot more of a list on the PFA, and your next bill will be to jump X, Y, and Z on the PFA list. We've already, I think, got a couple of those in this year now, but I won't go too deep down that road. So that's just the word of advice for your bill. On the second page, you have the municipality must retain for a period ending 1 year after the termination of property tax exemption section supporting written documentation for these findings under the paragraph. What you're saying is you're asking them to hold on to all documentation for that led to this decision. You're asking them to hold on to it for a total of 6 years?
I believe that's the intent. Yeah.
That's the intent. Okay. Well, then we'll have to figure. You should check and make sure on that one, too, just to make sure that that's how you're asking that, and so that people can, and I would say more than a year, to be honest, because people, if I'm a business owner in your community and I feel like I'm getting the short end of the stick, I might want to take a look at some of that and see how that got done. But my final question here is, and I don't know the answer to this, so it's always a rarity when you try to ask questions at the Capitol when you don't know the answer. But my understanding here is that you're exempting city, county, school, all property tax collections on this particular building or piece of property. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So can and this may be a tax question, but can't and Representative Kyle Keel alluded to the fact that the school board exempted some property taxes on them. So if you get the city and the county and the school, who can't do this now, I guess, is the question I'm asking. Can't this be done today already if you get the cooperation of your taxing authorities that hold that area in perpetuity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, if you got 100% cooperation, perhaps you could. I think that's very unlikely. And I've seen the county that I live in where they've been asked for a simple abatement to expand a business, and they've said no. I've never yet seen them say yes. And so it's a difficult thing for them to do. So
Representative Nordish, what you're saying is it's not just all the city slickers that are messing with the greater Minnesota. You guys do it to yourself?
I've witnessed. I've witnessed it, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney.
I couldn't let that pass.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nornes. I will ask questions that I don't know the answer to, and that's always dangerous, but we'll do that. I was a tire business for 23 years that had some tax increment financing that did affect someone else moving in and competing directly, and I was a outspoken opponent of that endeavor in those regards. But the way I read this bill, and maybe I'm wrong, but the thing I would have here is what we're trying to do is on buildings and improvements. For example, if I had wanted to add on to my business, the tax that would come from that improvement, the county or the city or whatever the taxing agent was, could exempt the improvement, basically. It's not saying that we're going to, because on the backside here it says that granting of this exemption will not adversely affect the property tax base of the city, county, or so on. So you're not eliminating the tax that I'm already paying. Is what you're saying is you're going to encourage me to build a new building or expand my existing business, and you're going to give me a 5-year window to not have to be taxed on that improvement. And I cannot build an improvement if it's going to directly compete with someone else in the industry or adversely affect the property tax base for the schools and so on. It's just saying that you're exempting the tax implications if you do expand. If I'm wrong in that, then maybe I have some opposition to the bill. But if that is indeed the case, it sounds like a great way to encourage industry to grow and expand that's already there, or new industry to come in and build a building that would contribute to that economic development. More statements and questions, but I think we're maybe trying to find the negative here when it really doesn't exist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hancock, that kind of summarized pretty well the bill.
Yeah. Next, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thanks for bringing this here. I don't have a question, so I'll be very brief. I think through the this has all been very good discussion, but it's lost a little bit of focus of what I read as the intent, so maybe you can correct me if this is not the intent. That'll be on your burden. But I see this as a way to equip or empower towns that need to be creative. I have those towns in my district where they're trying to expand businesses, they're trying to bring people in. And if there are problems, if there is kind of, they're trying to do this, they're trying to skirt the system and stuff like that, that shows up in the hearing. Because what you're doing is you're empowering the local government body to be able to do this. It doesn't ensure that they're going to get this tax abatement. It doesn't guarantee it. It isn't a certain amount that's guaranteed. They just have the ability to do this. And so they can come up with these, Representative Mahoney, some of these, what if they try to do this instead of that and stuff like that. And I do trust the city councils or the counties. I think what you're trying to do here, if I understand properly, and you can correct me, is you just want to be able to empower them. Because, again, I have those towns that have to come up with these creative ways to do it. If we start legislating in this, all the protections of, well, we don't want this to happen, we don't want that to happen, we don't want this to happen, I think it'll just become, even if it became law, it would be a nice tool that would never be used. And I want to make sure that we empower those local people to make the decisions that they know best for their towns or counties.
Mr. Chair, I think that, again, Representative Miller, that sums it up. It's, you can talk to your economic development folks back in your communities and in your counties and ask them how their toolbox looks, and they'll probably say, I don't even have one. So this is trying to put something in that toolbox.
Okay, Representative Norton.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just don't want to walk away from this until we've kind of gone full circle. I understand what the author's trying to do, and some of his explanation did make sense. But the fact is, you're letting one entity make a decision that will impact the property taxes of a school district and a county and a city, but only one entity is making that decision, that those others aren't going to get the property taxes. And the scenario you gave, that the five-year limit, that people might not be working in that, is true, but on the other hand, people might be working in it. And if people work in it and they bring children and families to the town, there's going to be an increased burden, and particularly in a small town, and the schools that are going to be harmed if they're not getting the property tax base to help support. That's why we do this, is to help support the community and the schools with that money. And so I just, one scenario you gave, I understand, and it makes sense, but there are other scenarios because this bill is so wide open. I just think if you're going to move on with this, you need to firm up some of those loopholes, like allowing all three of the governments or four of the governments to make the decision, not one for all of them. And or if someone does move in and is actually working in that expanded business at some point, that there is acknowledge that there is a burden on the community, and that that loss of property taxes could affect the community during those 5 years. You know, as I said, this Job Z and others have tried to do things like this. Some have been more successful than others, but I think this is awfully wide open yet, and I just would urge you to try to tweak it as you move along.
Representative Norton, there are some people who are very concerned about how this bill will adversely affect city, county, or school districts collections. I can probably counteract that somewhat by saying that if this building produces jobs, it will also produce school kids, so the schools will be made whole. The county can say it will also produce eventually property taxes. But as you heard the testimony today, I would recommend that you hold this bill over before it goes to taxes to take care of some of the things that members have pointed out, and we'll get you a list of those if you'd like.
I'd appreciate that.
And then we will I would recommend that you go to deed, because there's a few programs that are available for projects like this, and they'd be happy to point those out to you. And if your permission, I'd like to hold this bill over before we send it, have it heard again and send it to taxes.
Is that the way you'd like to have it done? I'd only add in the closing that if this doesn't happen, there is no taxes collected. So that's the choice you make.
I agree with that. So with that, we'll hold this bill over, and Representative Norris will take care of some of the objections members had, and hopefully we'll have it come back soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have, you aren't off the hot seat yet, I'm afraid.
Could I change chairs? Would that help?
Again, if you'd like. If it would cool your chair off, I'd be glad to see you do it. House file 496. I'll move House file 496 for pass and be sent to this tax committee. Please describe your bill for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House file 496 has to do with taxes again, another exemption. This time we're trying to strengthen the resort business. We've got in my area and all across the state of Minnesota aging resorts, and we want them to be encouraged to update and make them very attractive to our people that enjoy our Minnesota summers at the resort. So what we have is an exemption for materials and supplies used to improve the structures at our resorts. And to probably go into more detail, we have Dan McElroy here to do that.
Welcome to our committee. Please give your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. Let me thank Representative Norris for bringing the bill. I'll explain. It really has kind of two sets of arguments, an economic development case, which I'd like to make today, and be happy to talk about some of the tax issues, but which we expect to have to make in the tax committee. This bill was considered in 2013 and was included in the House Omnibus Tax Bill by then-Chair Representative Lynn Chesky. Didn't make it through conference committee. We want to bring it back. It is important to the resort industry in Minnesota. Minnesota is part of both its economy and its brand is that our resorts are an important part of being the land of 10,000 lakes or the land of sky blue waters. And the industry has changed dramatically, and in some extent it's gotten smaller. A study done in 1975 by the University of Minnesota Extension Service studied the industry in 1970 and found that 40-some years ago there were 2,527 resorts in Minnesota. According to numbers that Department of Revenue and Explore Minnesota Tourism worked on, in 2013 there were about 800 resorts remaining in Minnesota. Some of them are larger than they had been. There are about 8,000 resort cabins and lodge rooms in Minnesota today, but many of them are aging. We have four century resorts in Minnesota, resorts that have been in existence under the same family for more than 100 years. We compete for resort guests not only within the state but with other states. Many of our guests, when we talk to them at when they call or we meet them at resort shows in Sioux Falls or Fargo or Des Moines or Chicago, they're choosing between coming to Minnesota or Wisconsin or Michigan or a variety of other places. And the age and condition of structures is a big issue to them. And the in working with the Department of Revenue, we estimated that a renovation of a typical resort cabin costs between $30,000 and $40,000. About 60% of that is materials. We can make it more affordable and financeable and more likely to happen with an exemption on the materials. And it's consistent with how we treat other assets used to create a taxable product. All resort sales for less than 30 days, if you're staying for a month or less, are subject to the Minnesota sales tax and local lodging tax. It's been a principle of taxation that the equipment used to produce a taxable product, the capital investment, usually things like manufacturing machinery and equipment, and a variety of other types of machinery and equipment, are exempt from tax because they're creating a taxable product. Resorts aren't treated consistently in that manner, in that we have to pay sales tax on both the capital used to generate revenue and the revenue itself. The hospitality industry broadly collects about 17% of Minnesota sales tax because there's very little that we sell that isn't taxable, an occasional t-shirt. And other than that, everything we sell is taxable. We represent about 11% of the jobs in the state, about 5% of GDP, and about 17% of sales tax. We think the payback on this investment, and just although it's a tax issue, I'll tell you the revenue note is about $500,000 a year, and that the payback in increased rates and in increased rentals will be a good investment. And as an example, I use a resort called Hideaway Bay on Woman Lake near Hackensack. That the cabins were built in 1948 to 1960. And 2 years ago, Mark Novotny renovated and updated those cabins to make them modern, to have nicer showers and bathtubs, more modern open kitchens. And he went from renting them on average 11 or 12 weeks a year to 20 weeks a year, new rents and sells. And the revenue lost by the state from the sales tax will be paid back in a relatively short period of time. We're still working on an ROI calculator, but it's certainly in the 5 or 6 year range because of increased revenue and the likelihood that that resort will compete in the long term. So with that, Mr. Chairman, unless you have something you want to add, we'd be happy to take questions.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nords and Mr. McElroy. I'm somewhat familiar with the resort industry, and I've watched some of those small homespun resorts morph into bigger ones as they get absorbed by other resorts. So that might explain some of the reduction in numbers of resorts, but I know there's some monsters up around Brainerd that are doing just fine. And I guess we can look back about 20 years when there was a lot of farms going bankrupt in the state of Minnesota, so it's not out of the state's realm to help out businesses that are in crisis in groups. But if you can quantify for us, you know, what's the bankruptcy rate for resorts in the last 20 years or so, you know, and campgrounds, you know, is there a crisis involved here, or are we just being nice to businesses just to be nice? And I know a lot of resort owners that are doing quite well.
Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sundin, It is not bankruptcy that is the threat. It's the redevelopment of the land when the land value exceeds the business value, and the sale of resorts to become lake cabins or family estates. At its peak, the Rutgers family had 6 resorts in Minnesota. The Cross Lake Rutgers is now a single-family summer cabin. Doesn't collect sales tax, doesn't collect local lodging tax, doesn't creates 1 or 2 jobs, not the number of jobs it created in the past. We lost 5 members this year to conversion to family compounds or to subdivision. And so the issue is, will the business enterprise make more money than the real estate value, and then will they continue to contribute to our brand value and to the kind of the industry? A resort has to have a certain amount of a resort area, has to have a certain amount of mass to generate the number of people it takes to keep restaurants open and gift shops open and downtown merchants open. Only one resort in a county or even a township doesn't create the kind of energy that a robust industry creates. I'll go back to the fact that we've gone from 2,527 resorts to 800 as example that obviously the industry has been under pressure. Yes, there are a handful of big resorts that you describe. There are, might have to look, I think there are 40 or 41 resorts with over 100 lodging units and 750 that are much smaller than that. That gets you to the Maddens and Cragans and Grandviews and Breezy Points and Bluefin Bay and a couple of Arrowwoods. That list starts to get much smaller when you get very far beyond that. And yes, these people pay sales tax on the capital equipment to create a taxable product also. And yes, they will take advantage of the sales tax exemption. They'll also make investments that create construction jobs and prolong resort guests into the future.
If I can add, Mr. Chair, Thumper Pond to your list, that's another resort. It's a new one. But in my community or my area, if you talk to the businesses that try to survive in the summertime, who are resort towns, if you lose one resort, they notice it almost immediately because their traffic, those folks are the ones that come to town to look for shopping and enjoyment. The people that build a home at the lake come there to live there. They're not the same kind of customers.
Mr. Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, do you have bankruptcy numbers? How many resorts have gone bankrupt?
I do not. Because they usually get sold rather than going bankrupt. And they get sold often for non-resort purposes, but not entirely. I can look in the bankruptcy records, but that's not where my phone rings. My phone rings when Limmer's Resort in Otter Tail County is sold to be a family compound instead of a resort. And that happened a few months ago.
Mr. Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So going back to what you ultimately said, is a lot of these resorts have left the business to go into the real estate business, selling off or whatever.
They've been bought. Because,
okay. Thank you.
And then we've lost the opportunity to have that resort customer come to our communities.
I think we should invite Mr. Carlson up so he can also help answer questions. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business in St. Paul, and I represent a group called the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. Our members are small, family-owned resorts where the owner lives at the resort. That's who puts your boat in the lake. That's who sells you the minnows and sometimes even cleans your fish if you're successful. I think Mr. McElroy has clearly articulated the need for this. And the problem that we have, not as resorters, and I don't want to say, gee, feel sorry for the resorts. Representative Sundin, I'm unaware, and I've been representing this group since 1996, I'm unaware of a single bankruptcy. A single one. And the reason is exactly why we're here. When the value of the property is worth more than the value of the going concern of the business, you sell. Because particularly when you have a 12 or 13 week season to try and keep your business in operation. And what that means, not for the resorter, because they do sell their property, but what that means for Minnesotans is that is what denies us our access to the great resources that we have. You know, most people cannot afford Lakeshore. their ability to enjoy the great outdoors in Minnesota is often provided through a resort visit. And when you talk about Minnesota memories and family vacations, much of that happens at a Minnesota resort, and we think that's awesome. I personally have been working on this issue for quite some time, and back when Mr. McElroy was a tax committee chair, and I have my fiscal note for the bill from the year 2001. And it illustrates the point that we're trying to make. The fiscal note in 2001 said we had 1,125 resorts in Minnesota. 14 years later, we're down to 800. That's over 325 resorts we've lost, almost 24 per year, that get sold for some other purpose. And once a resort is sold for private development, it never comes back. So without an ability to invest in your property and be able to remain competitive, it is very difficult to stay in the business, and that is why resort properties sell. So we certainly appreciate this bill, and Representative Nornes and everyone on this committee who has been so gracious about talking to resorters when they come for their day on the Hill. This is one that just helps you invest in your property, and we absolutely give it our full support. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and be happy to answer questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norns, maybe Mr. McElroy can ask this one of the questions I have. We have unfortunately a dwindling number of privately owned camp resorts and campgrounds. By chance, you know how what the state-run campgrounds and resorts have gone? If they've gone up, gone down, how many do we have?
Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there is only one state-run resort that I'm aware of, and that's the Douglas Lodge at Itasca State Park. There are 60-plus state campgrounds. We have stresses about competing with our government. They have, however, refrained from adding full hookups. They do have some electricity. We don't think the camper cabins maybe are the very best idea, in part because they are subject to different regulations than resort cabins. But the government doesn't particularly compete with private resorts except for camper cabins, which are relatively small and low amenity. They do compete on the campground side. Last I knew, and Joel, you may know, there are between 60 and 70 state park campgrounds. This National Forest Service has some fairly rustic campsites, but they're generally without utilities or hookups.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McElroy, one thing I was interested in that, because when they do upgrades or repairs at those campgrounds, they don't pay sales tax. They're tax exempt. So we have our businesses that are paying property taxes, paying sales tax, paying income tax, competing against our state-run businesses that don't have to pay any of these taxes. So I think the concept of this is a good idea, because without those, I have great memories of up at the resort we used to go to for a number of years in a row up in Representative Norris's area on 10 Mile Lake. We had a blast. The owners made it fun. I was maybe first or second grade, and they'd take us in the boat all the way out to Bird Island to have some fun out there, and they didn't charge my parents anything, but they wanted to have the kids to have a good time. And we need to keep these operations going for the experience, not only for our kids and our grandkids, but their kids as well.
And Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Carl,
The investment that you make in your facility and in your cabin is your capital improvement. And there are hundreds of examples where we exempt capital improvements for different business operations in the state. That is our capital improvement. And it is consistent for tax policy, because we do collect a sales tax every time we invest in that property and rent it. We do collect. When we buy an outboard motor or a boat, we don't pay sales tax on it. It's a throughput for us, because then every time we rent it, we pay sales tax on it. The cabin and the lodge is no different. Every time we rent it, we pay the sales tax on it, and it's just like a capital improvement exemption that this legislature's improved dozens of times, and that's why we think it's consistent tax policy.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't sit on a tax committee, so I'm trying to follow all the exempt taxes that happens in. But I guess one of the good news is that, you know, when a resort has to be sold, they're being bought up. I mean, the ground is not, it's not barren, right? So someone else is buying up that property. There's business going on. There's tax revenue that's been collected on that business. And so I'm sitting here just trying to think, you know, a family resort business, you know, why is that the state problem? Anyway.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Moran. That's an excellent point, and it gets to just what Representative Johnson was just talking about. First of all, when the resort is sold, it's not sold for commercial use. It is sold for private use. So no one else, no one sitting around the table here gets to have access to that resource. And so why it's a state issue and it's a quality of life issue for us is that those memories that are created and that what Explore Minnesota Tourism advertises about the quality of life in Minnesota and a family vacation on a good fishing lake, those opportunities are lost when those properties get converted for private use. They never... Rarely am I aware of a property that gets converted for other commercial use. It's always for private development. So you take what were 8 or 10 cabins, that our average member has 10 cabins, and you convert that, and your 300 feet gets divided up in 250-foot parcels, and that's now two property owners that get to use that resource, and you don't have families coming in there every week that get to use those cabins. That's the quality of life issue that we think is a state issue.
Members, we have two more bills after this, so you can make your answers very short, please.
Mr. Chairman, the other issue is job creation. Private households rarely have full-time help. They do their own work. Most of our resort members create jobs for housekeeping and dock attendants and people who sell bait and rent boats and pump gas and in many cases serve meals or drinks. We lose the job creation issue also. And so we think there is a public interest. It's also an interest of consistency. No other creator of a taxable product has to pay sales tax on their inputs.
Mr. Chair, one other question.
So
I heard you state that when the land value is worth more than the business value they sell. So the question is, do you have any data? I mean, if for whatever reason you feel you need to sell, you sell. And so do you have any data or any record or anything that would state that if a resort was able to get a tax break, tax exempt, to build, to upgrade, that it will create more of a stability for that resort?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moran, that is a really good question. And if the sales tax is 7% of 60% of the cost of the product, it's about 4% of the whole project. A resort owner is either investing their own capital or more likely borrowing money for the balance of that and signing their name at the bottom line of a mortgage. And so they're making a long-term commitment to the capital that's likely to keep it a resort. Some of them are SBA loans. There are some other programs. There is no longer a state resort program, as we did have in the 70s and 80s. But the state contribution is a relatively small portion. If the 60% number holds true, it's about a 4% of the cost. And the investor and the owner and their financing sources are putting up 96% of the money to protect access to natural resources and job creation.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one comment here. today's families are really looking for a good, positive experience. And most of them are not satisfied with an old, run-down facility that they maybe have gone to. So their expectations are much higher than they have been. In order to compete, the resorts need to be updated and attractive, and so the roof doesn't leak, stuff like that.
Tin showers just don't cut it anymore in resort business.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I understand memories and you know, wanting to have a good time and wanting to go to a resort that is in good shape. But I'm still struggling with whether or not that's the state responsibility.
And I would argue the state is providing a relatively small amount of assistance so that entrepreneurs can take on the majority of the responsibility. And we're treating them consistently with other people who create a taxable product.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. Well, I'm all for the bill and tell you why. Because where I work, where I operate, my resort, we don't pay any sales tax on anything. We don't pay it on anything we provide to our guests. Not a penny. But we pay, let me explain that. Everything we buy a tomato, we pay 13% sales tax, called harmonized sales tax. And then we pay it by a 2x4 or a nail or a hammer. Everything we pay 13% on. Up front, cash money. And it isn't easy. I can imagine 6.875% in the rural area that doesn't have any add-ons. But then we charge 13% tax on the guest, on the customer's tax bill, on the bill to visit us. And we take off the amount that we take the gross amount of tax that we collect from the guest, Representative Garofalo, and we use his tax, and we offset the tax that we pay to Home Depot or to the, you know, for shipping or for gasoline. There's 13% tax on gasoline, sales tax, on top of all the other road taxes. And we deduct that one from the other, and then we pay, submit the net remittance. So we basically pay zero. Mm-hmm. My question is, and I've always questioned this, in Ontario, when you sell a resort, you pay sales tax, the buyer pays sales tax on the price of the value of the sale. And that's where this bill, I believe, lacks. Because if I were in Minnesota operating and I got the break that you asked for, and then I spent 15 years fixing the place up at $40,000 a pop, that's $400,000, plus you know that they're going to every light bulb and every fixture and every toilet and everything else that they or anything they possibly can, they're going to get sales tax free because it goes if it goes for the right places. What is the clawback? Because in Minnesota, when you buy a resort, I don't believe you pay sales tax on the purchase price. Do we pay sales tax on the purchase price of a resort in Minnesota? So that's my first question. And then, but I'm specifically concerned about resorts that would take advantage of this opportunity. No, I want them to take advantage of the opportunity. That's what I want. But I don't want it to turn into exactly what's happened in my community, Representative Sundin, is I had two major resorts that two major families came in, bought the entire resort out, shut it down. All the kids in the family have their own cabin. They're now responsible for it. They aggregate the maintenance, and they're going to live forever in my community. And we already had, in the Voyageurs National Park, 76 resorts removed, 270 cabins, and our community is down to three viable properties in the tourism business. Mr. McElroy knows who they are. He's been to all of them. It's a huge problem. The last thing is I'm not sure if you take $40,000 investment in a cabin. First off, a cabin doesn't cost $40,000. It costs one heck of a lot more to get to the standard today, more like $125,000 to $50,000 or higher. So you take 6.875% times $40,000, you end up with $44,000 and some dollars of that. I'm worried for the state that we don't get that back when we sell the resort. So I had a whole bunch of questions in there. I know you know what they all are, so let's hear the answers.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, previous permutations of this bill did have a three-year clawback provision so that you didn't just build your owner's house and get the exemption and then sell it off or go out of business. So it did have a three-year clawback in it, and I think that's a good and valid point. The $40,000 number that Mr. McElroy was talking about was for an improvement. Even in 2001, the average cost for a new unit was $70,000 estimated in the bill, and so we know that number is substantially higher. So I don't disagree with your number but a way to balance that out so that there is some protection for the taxpayer, so it's not abused, we think is appropriate. You also need to know that revenue is very specific with us about what construction material means. It doesn't include the light bulbs. It only includes the material used to physically expand the resort and not to operate it, and that's in the fiscal note, which isn't before you, but we think it's pretty tight and not used for every roll of toilet paper that you buy. So,
Mr. Chairman, last thing.
Representative Dill.
I know this is getting longer, but I think that it could be possible to look into the idea that if the resort is going to continue to be a resort, that there's a carry forward, that the movement, the price of the resort would be then lower to the next owner, so that then if they sold it and it went out of 4C or one, whatever the classification is in the tax code, that then that person buyer sold the paid the tax, so that it, in other words, it's like a tax credit moving forward through the buyers to try and incentivize, because this is a huge problem, committee, this privatization of properties on Lakeshore. I mean, it's pretty glorious when a resort owner who's ready to retire can get, must just throw out a number, $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million, $5 million cash payment, take 30% down and the rest on payments, and watch his kids spend the rest of it when he's dead. That works pretty good. But to try and build a new resort from the ground up is nearly impossible. So I like the idea, but there are just some things that I think need to be worked on. And I know this isn't the tax committee, but I'm not on the tax committee, thank God. I did that for 8 years.
And we'd like to get to a point where the retirement plan for the resort isn't just simply selling it.
Correct.
That's where we'd like to get.
And last, we have Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a couple of interesting questions, but lieu of time, I'll just make a pitch for the state parks. I mean, all those great memories I had were at Sibley State Park, Scenic State Park, Itasca, Gooseberry, all those 75 or 80 state parks that have big campgrounds and great memories.
I got a dirty look from the chair, so I thought I'd better
sure. You worry about it.
Mr. Chair, we thank you for all the time that you've devoted to this.
And with that, I'll renew my motion to have House File 496 pass and be sent to taxes. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion passes. You're going to taxes.
Oh, boy.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
And now we have Representative Albright. You want to move this one? Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Green?
I'd like to move House File 872 to be referred to jobs.
Very well. Please explain your bill for us.
Mr. Chair and members, before you is House File 872, which is a net operating loss bill. And I'll paraphrase a little bit in terms of the upfront, and then I will turn over the discussion to Ms. Genevieve Plumador, who is with Life Science Alley, or Life Science. Minnesota's economy has long benefited from a strong research emphasis based on corporations such as Medtronic, 3M, Boston Scientific, and St. Jude Medical. Companies emerging with this cutting-edge technology today are small startups that are facing, in some cases, an uphill battle for the crucial early-stage funding needed to bring them to the next phase in their development of life-saving therapies that we will all benefit from. The NOL, or Net Operating Loss Marketplace Bill that you have before you is genuinely unique in that it could potentially infuse capital into those early stage companies during this crucial period in their development so that Minnesota can continue to have one of the most robust medical technology ecosystems in the nation. With that, I will turn it over to Ms. Plumador for further explanation of the bill.
Welcome to our community. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Genevieve Plumador here on behalf of Life Science Alley. I thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you today about this truly unique idea to help bolster the development of early stage companies here in Minnesota. As you know, Minnesota has one of the most robust and highly concentrated medical device and medical technology communities in the world. The program is meant to address the funding hurdles for high technology startups going through the early cycles of research and development, in addition to the costly and rigorous FDA approval process. So how does the program work? Currently, a company can carry forward their Minnesota operating losses, net operating losses, or NOLs as they're commonly known, to a taxable year in the future when they have a tax liability. Under this program, a biotech company can transfer or sell those NOLs that have been unused, and they can, once they sell them on the marketplace, can reinvest those dollars directly into their business in that same taxable year. A profitable company can then buy those NOLs at a discounted rate on an online marketplace. The only other state that has such an innovative program is New Jersey. And you ask, why New Jersey? Because they have a significant biotechnology industry that rivals Minnesota's in the biopharmaceutical space. In the 10-year study we have provided for the committee, New Jersey found that they actually had made money in those 10 years of investments that they made through this NOL program. Because those businesses are able to infuse that operating capital into their business that immediate taxable year in the form of wages, equipment purchases, which would then generate new tax revenues for the state and stimulate economic activity and growth in the state. By surrendering the tax benefit now, the small firms that become profitable will start paying corporate taxes sooner, which would further reduce the cost of the program to the state. Additionally, New Jersey did find that the program stimulated further collaborations within their research institutions and higher ed institutions, and incentivized profitable companies to handpick which NOLs that they would purchase so that they would be investing in new innovative therapies and new innovative innovations in this space. So this would be an absolute groundbreaking program here in Minnesota. When I talk to our members about what the state can do for them to help stimulate growth in the pipeline, this is one of the programs that they that really grabs their attention and gets them very excited. The NOL marketplace would be a powerful economic tool used to spur innovation and continue to foster our coveted high-tech hub. And with that, I will stand for questions.
Very well. Any questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Green, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion. To move House File 872 to Jobs.
Be all in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
You're welcome. Anybody know where Representative Earhart is?
Right here, Mr.
Hey, just in time. Welcome to our committee. No, don't do that. I don't want to pick you up. I will move House File 665 to pass and be sent to taxes. Your bill is moved. Please describe your bill.
I have some amendments and handouts. Apparently, okay. They were not sent to you electronically, so.
Well, you want to have those first?
Yeah, okay. I think we better put them out there.
Okay, where's this? No, we got an amendment. Anyone? Yeah? Everybody should have that amendment. But me. Okay, since we all have the A1 amendment, you want to describe your amendment, please?
Members, Mr. Chairman, it's almost, this is a combination of two ideas that came together, so one of them is an amendment form. You almost ought to start with the amendment first.
Okay, we are.
And that amendment is.
I will move the A1 amendment. Go ahead.
Thank you. This is an attempt to begin to lower the statewide taxes on commercial and industrial property and on the seasonal rec category of property, too. And I see that we have the property tax staff from upstairs here, so that maybe can help me out if necessary, which will probably be the case. The levy says that the state general levy is levied against commercial, industrial property, and seasonal residential recreational property as defined in this section. The state general levy has been solidified at $854,360,000. That started out at about $400,000, I think, when it, $400 million when it went into effect, and it's grown that much. But the bill causes that to be frozen at $854,360,000, payable in 2016 and thereafter. And the bill itself addresses another one portion of that. Actually, it addresses both halves of the. But a little background: in 2001, we did a big changeover of the property tax system in order to help out homes and business. And as it turned out, I was the chair of the property tax division at that time. And Representative Abrams was the chair of the tax committee. And in the, there are several versions of this, but I have talked to lobbyists who were present at the, where they put this bill together at the end in the conference committee. And they were looking for some extra money to close the bill up, and this is how this came about in the manner it did. Seasonal rec was put in here because they needed a little more, but it's kind of unusual that you have seasonal rec in a statewide property tax. But for the purposes of balancing at that time, that was done. So, and as a matter of fact, the whole idea of the state putting a property tax on various on the two classes of property was instigated. And this has grown considerably over the years, and it's a burden on business, but it's also a burden on seasonal and recreational cabin owners. They don't have any income in which to offset the property taxes. I forgot to bring my bill for last year, but my bill for my cabin is about $2,300 and some change, and the seasonal, the statewide tax on seasonal and rec property are on that property were $690, so more than about a third of the tax, which you think would go to the local units. Normally, your local units of government are the ones that benefit from the property taxes. So what this bill does is, first of all, freezes the state general levy at $854,360,000 for taxes payable to 2016 and on. And it removes the increase, therefore, each year thereafter. It would also phase it would phase out the general state general levy on seasonal and rec property over 5 years. And the way it works is, as depicted on the figures that we have on it. I might go to the revenue report if that's proper at this time. And it gives the mechanism on the revenue report. Of how this happens. It switches 1% of the seasonal rec property taxes to of the seasonal rec to commercial industrial property 1% a year for 5 years. The cost savings to business are, however, evident. There is another bill that sees that freezes the state levy at 854, but does not do anything with as for. So there's a cost savings of business on that, but does nothing about seasonal rec. It seems to me that we can do both of them here without adding anything to business levy. And the cost of business savings will be a little less at the beginning, the first 5 years, but then will increase after that. I think the reason that I'm here today thinking about this is because there have been a lot of cabins of families for years and years, and a lot of them have been driven off the cabin, family cabins, because of the ever-increasing property taxes, and in this particular instance, by one that was kind of put in here to close out the tax bill in 2001. I think the necessity for what we're talking about here can be illustrated by Jeff Forrester, who was with me, he can introduce himself, but I'd like to call him to the stand here and let him speak to the
welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forster, and I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates. And we're made up of cabin owners, hunting land owners, shoreland property owners, lake associations, a couple of watershed districts, people interested in water. And to Representative Earhart's point, we've been mystified why family cabins and family hunting shacks have been subject to a commercial property tax since 2001. We don't see any relationship between the two, and you know there's there was a budget hole and we plugged the hole and it would be I think fair that at least cabins weren't included in this tax anymore. There's the idea that I hear sometimes, well, you know, if you can afford two homes, then you can afford to pay the taxes. But what's interesting is when you start to break down the numbers, we did a survey back in 2005 and found that the average household income of a Minnesota cabin owner is $58,000 a year. So by and large, they're middle-income people. They contribute about $4,000 a year to the local communities where these cabins are located, these hunting shacks. You know, there are people that decide to stay here in Minnesota and recreate here in Minnesota rather than taking a trip to Mexico or Vail, Colorado or something. And I was thinking as I was listening to Joel Carlson testify, you know, he talks about the family and the family memories and stuff. And, you know, I know at our place, it's not just our family. It's been Boy Scout troops. It's been Girl Scout troops. My parents' plumber used to use our place. There's a lot of people associated with these places. And the number of people that have had to sell them because they just can't afford to hold them anymore has been increasing dramatically. So I can stand for any questions. And the other thing I was thinking is, You know, people tend to assume that it's people from the cities. I heard the argument about people from the cities going up north. And I wanted to kind of clarify that. I looked at the number of cabin owners that live in each district, and I thought you would want to know who on this committee had the most cabin owners that live in their district, not who have a cabin in the district, but live in the district and own a cabin in Minnesota. The top one is David Dill, with 1,716 cabin owners living in his district. So what you've got is a situation where people live in town, and they have a cabin or a hunting shack just outside of town or on the lake, and they're paying the school taxes, and then they're paying this tax. It's very difficult. My share of the state general tax is $700 a year, which is about a third.
We have questions from Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, I like the concept of what you're doing here, capping the taxes on, especially on businesses. Businesses get the brunt of it. They get hit very hard on taxes. But I've also done a little bit of looking up on things, and I'm wondering if this proposal that you're doing similar to California's Proposition 13?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I have no idea what Proposition 15 is. So you tell me, and then I'll tell you if we're doing that.
That is a voter initiative out of California that exactly is doing exactly what your bill was, or your amendment is. But it capped the increase at 2% instead of 1%. And that particular bill had an adverse effect on home ownership altogether throughout the state of California, because it ended up older people living in their homes longer, younger people renting longer, not being able to buy a home because it increased the cost, and the actual property taxes on the individual homes skyrocketed. So I like the concept of doing away with the business, especially the business tax, but the adverse effect on actual homeowners is not as what it's intended to do.
Okay, I think before we go any farther, we should probably get this bill in the way you'd like it, Representative Earhart, and pass the A1 amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I will move the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion carried. Now to your bill as amended. We have Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Earhart, I'm generally supportive of what you're trying to do here, but I've got information in front of me that leads me to believe that with your measures, you're going to leave a $150 million hole, or reopen that $150 million hole in lost tax revenues. So I'm just wondering, I was looking at your jacket, I don't see any bulges in your pocket. I'm just wondering where that money is going to come from to patch that hole again.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, on the revenue note, it says that the first year that this is done, 2016, would be $8,300,000 comes out of the general. That's the loss of the general fund. And in the second, 2017, it's $25,100,000. In the in 18, it's $45,400,000. And in 2019, it's $68,600,000. And that's money that comes out that's no longer available to the general fund because that's where it's going. So, to pay for that, you're going to have to find some money. Now, who do we tax to get the money for making up the hole? We have a growing surplus that will be with us for a number of years, and like everybody else, this seems like a worthwhile cause.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you that We may be looking at some money here, but in the short term, if that money doesn't materialize, or get spent by somebody else, which is a real probability. Are we going to borrow it from schools, or where's it going to come from if it doesn't materialize, or if somebody else spends it first?
I have a printing press in my basement, Mr. Chairman, if you need any help. Actually, you can expect a growing amount of... It's coming from Mr. Marks, but he hasn't got it to me yet. There's only two times in the last 30 years that our revenues to the state haven't increased, and they were in the years 1929 and 2010. We're in the, every year the revenues have increased. I got here in 1991, and the budget revenues were then about $13 billion. Now they're about $42 billion. So that's what our economy keeps growing, and we keep people working, and they keep buying things, and they keep spending money, and we, if their income tax goes up, our sales tax go up. So there's no magic here. In order to satisfy your question, I'm just suggesting that that's one of the reasons that we should be, number one, helping out the cabin owners and their family traditions of owning those cabins, and helping out business as well. The they do a benchmark on here, which I haven't seen before, on property tax benchmarks, and they say transparency on this bill is understandable, simplicity, and accountable. And there's an increase in that. Efficiency and compliance is neutral. Equity is neutral. Stability and predictability is neutral. And competitiveness for business is an increase. Responsive to economic conditions is neutral.
With that, Representative Mahoney.
No, I got no questions.
Representative Norton.
Oh, boy. Well, I think I've got to be one of the 10 people in the state of Minnesota that doesn't own a cabin. I've been amazed. Oh, good. There's the other. There, well, all right. We got all 10 of us here. That's great. It has amazed me, actually, the number of cabin owners of every socioeconomic, you know, status in the state of Minnesota. And I know it's part of the lifestyle here. I'm really sad that David Dill has left, because your reference to hunting shacks has just made me feel really good. For those of you that were around long enough to hear a freshman on the House floor get herself in really big trouble calling it a duck shack as opposed to a duck blind. David Dill was there and has never let me forget this. There's a YouTube video about that if you ever want to see it.
You in a duck blind?
It's not very pretty. But anyway, no, I'm talking about them. Actually, no, my only comment here is, you know, we don't want to tax the people that own the hotels or the resorts. We don't want to tax the homeowners that are buying the resort land. Who's going to pay for the kids' education and the stuff that goes on in the towns and the streets if we take everybody out of the tax pool? So, you know, I understand people with resorts, you know, I don't live there full time, I don't want to pay taxes, but somebody and that's one of the reasons this law is in place, is somebody has to pay for the communities, these tiny little communities. So I guess what we've heard today is two separate groups that are all saying not me, and so I'm wondering who will be left.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee?
For the children. Who will be left for the children?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a point of clarification, that none of the state general taxes return to local communities. The revenues from this tax do not add a dime to local schools.
But, Mr. Chairman, these cabins do pay the capital costs on new schools.
Right. We pay the capital improvement levies. In fact, we had a line on my bill is for $235 for a pool at the Tower Sedan School, and I had a four-year-old daughter, and they were having swimming lessons, and our place is on an island, so I thought, well, she should learn to swim. So I took her over to town and went to the pool, and They said you can't use the pool because you're not a resident. But we have a $235 line every year. The school has now been closed, but I'm still paying for the pool.
Representative Keel's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out, I was a former cabin opener, and partly why we sold it was because we were mowing the yard and checking things out and going home again, and paying the taxes on it just wasn't worth it. It had been the family for a long time. But my point would be is we were still paying taxes. You'd still end up paying some taxes on it because it's a property, but you wouldn't be paying the high taxes on it. And of course, I know there are two different kinds. I mean, I've seen two different kinds of cabins. The ones that look like you're going to the lake and don't really care if the dishes are done and, you know, you enjoy it. And then there are those that look like a resort and then some. So, you know, and I've seen many people just live out there year-round. That's what they end up doing is... But I think it's some concern. We're chasing some people away. In my district, we see a lot of North Dakotans purchase cabins and then come east. So, you know, we're enjoying some of that oil money in that direction. But I just think it needs to be reasonable, I guess would be my concern, is that the taxes we're paying are, you know, if you own that home. But anyway, thank you.
With that, I see no more questions. So I will renew my motion to have House File 665, as amended, be passed and sent to taxes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to taxes, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, members and Mr. Chairman.
And I see no other business, so we are adjourned.